Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie eine umweltfähige Zukunft macht.
Welcome to today's episode for the podcast of the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy. And this is season 2, where we explore how to get groups of people into coherence, how to build community effectively. And I am really happy and honored to have Abdul here today. He's doing an amazing work in Africa, and he was connected with me through our friends, mutual friends in Australia, who are sparking the community of communities called Imagination. Abdul, welcome. And let's immediately begin with the most difficult question of them all. Who are you?
Thank you, Thomas, for having me. It's a pleasure. Who am I? Who is Abdul Senokula? So Abdul Senokula, I'm a Ugandan in Kampala, living in Kampala. I started off as a web developer, developing websites and software for small and medium businesses, but also government sometimes. And at the peak of our operations, we exported our services towards Europe and the UAE in Dubai. So, but along the way, I shifted towards more civic innovation, building citizen state interaction platforms for accountability and transparency, access to data, government data, and also the goal was that people get involved in governing. Government data is hard to access, hard to interpret, but also hard to react to respond to. So how do we connect these many government databases and be able to engage the populace in governance? Then I shifted towards social innovation. How do we handhold groups of women out of poverty through productization, but also access to finance? Then I shifted towards climate finance, climate innovation. How do we increase the volume and velocity of money that is reaching grassroots climate action? And just a few years ago, I shifted towards regenerative innovation, regenerative development and design. And in all these shifts, I wasn't comfortable working on symptoms of systemic failure. I kept searching for the root causes, going down to what is causing this. And during that I did a regenerative development and design course with Regenesis, and which shifted my entire understanding of how, not just how we inhabit the earth, but also how we work, how we do what we do. And so that took me on a route of this rediscovering who I am. Okay. So I am the name Semakula is a name of the Pangolin clan in Buganda, which is a kingdom here in Uganda. So the pangolin is one of the most trafficked animals, is the most trafficked animal in the world. But it's also a keystone species because it controls ant populations, but also aerates the soil. And I just read a few weeks back that it also doesn't thrive under captivity. And so in some cultures, it's called a guardian of the forest, okay? The pangolin. So I've been trying to rediscover myself as a steward, as a guardian of our biocultural heritage. And one of the things I've come to realize when I shifted towards regenerative development and design was that the poly crisis we are facing, the climate crisis, is not about carbon emissions. It's not about carbon, but it's about the broken relations between humans and nature. It's about the broken relations between communities and their ecosystems. It's about the broken relations between our economic systems and the living world. And so I have been, so that regenerative imperative is really to rebuild, to restore these broken relations for life to thrive, and so that we are in relation with life again. So who am I? I'm someone who is working towards that future where there are healthy relations between humans and nature.
Okay. Wonderful. Yes. Thank you. And before we move on, I have some curiosity about some of the aspects of what you just shared. And I want to start with the question of, in that first step in your journey that you described, did you program yourself? Are you a programmer?
Yes.
And I have observed in many programmers that the sheer act of programming changes something in their worldview, that's in their philosophy. Have you observed something like that in yourself? And if so, how does programming reflect on your worldview and philosophy?
Thank you. That is true. It gets you. When I used to program, you had this curiosity towards deeply understanding something, so that it is basically deeply understanding something in a way that solves their. Gives a solution to what's whatever you're trying to solve. So it's this deep understanding. It's like a programming is this condition, fertile condition for thinking at a deeper level. Yeah, that's what I can say.
It's very, very similar to what I found, which is that it forces you to rethink in first principles and also extrapolate into complex systems, because you're required to hold a whole entire complex system that you're working on in your mind. But there's a third factor, which is you have agency within that complexity, because you, as an software engineer, you can change the first principles such that the shape of the complex system changes also.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So I assume that was something that happens to you that. Also informed your quest for first principles in the way we do things as humans, right?
I totally agree. It had a deep a central core impact on the route I finally took, or where I finally am here.
And slowly moving into our topic today, but still exploring this piece a little bit more. On your journey, what are the most important first principles about how we do things as humans that you found that are relevant to the shift that you are searching for?
Yes. So I'll go back to the shifts that happened to during that regenerative development and design course. One of them is this focus on problem on the problem solution track. Okay. So it's before taking that course, I like problem solving is a highly sought after skill, you know. When I took that course, it helped me understand that the focus on this problem solution framing is actually the problem. You know, so we get held up on this trap of what's it called, the wheel. The hamster wheel, yeah.
Hamster wheel, yeah.
The hamster wheel of problem solving, and problem creating, and problem solving. You know, so you solve this, you fix this problem, you create five others, and then you solve the five, you get 25 more problems. And what regeneration invites us is to instead see potential and harness that potential, coordinate resources to harness that potential and manifest it. So problems can be fixed or managed, but potential can be realized, you know. That's an important.
Can I see if I understand that correctly by reflecting it back?
Okay.
And you're basically saying that if you engage in problem solution sets, you're likely to solve a very narrow
exactly
problem, exactly, and ignoring the complexity that this problem solution set is embedded within the entire ecosystem it is part of, and thereby creating second, third, fourth order side effects,
yes,
unintended, that are often negative. And then you start chasing all of these other problems, and by trying to solve them in the exact same way, you're exacerbating the actual escalation of the problem landscape.
Exactly. And now we have what we call, what's the word? I forget. Wicked problems.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the collection of problems is you call a wicked problem, right?
Exactly.
And now, but just to finish my understanding, you're saying that the thing you learned in that regeneration course is. I would paraphrase it as follows. Instead of trying to find solutions to problems, you find dispositions within the complex system, within the ecosystem, that yes, if they yes are nurtured, they have the ability to move the entire ecosystem into a preferred path.
Yes. Okay. Because you said it well, when you focus on problem solving, you don't see the whole. You don't see the whole. So with potential, you are invited to see the whole. And work with knowledge of the whole and now ask, how do we contribute towards, how do different stakeholders contribute towards a healthier whole?
Mm-hmm.
And developing the potential of each individual in the whole to manifest the vitality and of the whole and its capacity to evolve into a higher order, mm-hmm. Being or potential.
Beautiful. What other first principles have you discovered, if any?
Place.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Place. Yes. When I went into this course, I found that the course was so much focused on place. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was coming from this background of digital innovation, and the concept of place didn't resonate so much. Yeah. And so I gave myself all sorts of reasons that this course is developed by permaculturists, by architects, by landscapers. So it's obvious that they would glorify place. But during one session, they invited us to image a place in a regenerative end state. You know, and when I imaged their place, by imaging, I mean a visual image, creating a visual image in my mind, in your mind. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you can imagine yourself, for example, in a swimming pool, mm-hmm. and what's the temperature, how are your hands moving and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
an image, okay? So when they invited us to image a place in a regenerative end state, and I imaged the place where I live, everything just changed. I like this, so much reasoning that I was justifying myself arguing against place, it all was cut off, you know, and that's the power of imaging or visualizing a different future, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I that was so profound, it shifted my whole focus, and I'm now also glorifying place like those other guys. So and that goes back to what I started with, that there are broken relations between communities and their ecosystems, communities and their places.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So working from place,
mm-hmm.
is a core first principle
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
consider. Yes.
And the reason for that, I assume, if I understand it correctly, is that historically, for the last at least a couple of 100,000 years, we have been embedded in place, even as a nomadic tribe in a bioregion, and where we had multiple places, but we moved from place to place.
Yes.
And we had a very, very deep experiential knowledge of that place.
Excellent.
So we had a deep understanding, an intuitive system one type deep understanding of that place, so that we could actually, in the way we just talked about problem solving versus nurturing dispositions of complex systems, we could actually nurture dispositions of complex systems or thrive with the complex system that we were embedded in.
Exactly.
And so that we find that this is so deeply embedded in our human nature that this is probably the best place we can unfold meaningful, prosperous action towards a good world in place. Is that roughly right?
Perfectly right. I was doing a story of place and what came up for me was that we are now, because of this disconnection from place, colonial beliefs and stuff like that, we are physically in place, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I'm physically in Uganda, but spiritually, I'm in the West.
Mm.
Emotionally, in the West, and mentally, in the West, like colonized, you know, and that takes away, in a way, your agency to contribute to the health of the place. You know, there's a way to pulls you to contribute to this empire of extractive empire, rather than the health of the place that is near you, that is in which you are embedded. You know, so yeah, refocusing on place is an easy way to evoke agency, revitalize agency, human agency, towards higher order purpose and meaningful in life.
Okay. And that is now the work you're doing, right? So now you're in place with place and people, and you are working on identifying the dispositions of that complex system and nurturing it into something that is better for all, right? Kind of like becoming the keystone or apex custodian species we could be, right?
Yes.
So how do you do that? What's your process? How do you get the people and the ecosystem to engage in that process? What are the questions you ask? What are the things you do?
Yes. What we did, I think to it's better to let me go back to
okay.
to how we. We are doing the work that we are doing here. So the idea is, if you want to find coherency, you have to start from what people value, you know, and what the life they dream of, again, in the context of their place. And so what we did is do exercises or co-design exercises of understanding what people value, their challenges, and the life they dream of in this place. And then that becomes the basis for a trusted, long-lasting relationship. A lasting collaborative process of now seeing, so reconciling these human dreams with what the place actually wants. So coherence, when you talk of coherence, you also want to mean that these human dreams are coherent with the dreams of the place, if I could say it like that. So what we are trying to do here is exactly that: reconcile human dreams with the dreams of the place, which is a wetland. And we went in a little bit creatively, and it's hard because people are used to this idea of getting information pumped into their head,
mm-hmm.
yeah, rather than evoking, enabling them to basically using questions to derive knowledge, so that they are the source of their knowledge, okay,
mm-hmm.
of knowledge and insight. So people are used to that idea, and it wasn't easy at first. But what we did is you go into a place, we get a neighbor to invite, to host their neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and then we ask, we come with our fruits. So this is deeply cultural. We come with our fruits, and then you tell us what's, you pick a fruit, for example, a banana, and then you tell us what's it, or you answer the question, what was a good, remember a good day in this place, and tell us what made that day sweet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to know what people value, you know? Then on a hard day, on a hard day, you tell us, maybe you pick a chili and tell us, what's a hard day in this place? You tell us a story, mm-hmm. of a hard day in this place. Then we know that this thing challenges people.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the dreams, you pick a pack of fruits and tell us how the life you dream of in 5-10 years. You speak to each fruit, and it was interesting to see how people use the texture of the fruits, the smell of the fruit,
mm-hmm.
and you know, to describe their dream life and the things they value in life, but also their challenges. So that's how we did that. Basically, it starts from understanding what people value,
mm-hmm.
and their dreams.
Does it really start there, or does it start at creating a safe space? Because it seems to me that the first thing is you're creating a safe space by going to their home,
mm-hmm.
And then tapping into a cultural tradition that is familiar, bringing fruits, and then using that as the substrate for the conversation. So there's a lot of care in the way you approach this, that it makes it a safe space. At least that's what I'm seeing.
No, that's the whole picture. I think zeroed on the actual activity, mm-hmm. but that's very important, the space. And one of the learnings, mm-hmm. one of the learnings we got there is that these spaces of communing are very important in shifting, what is missing actually in shifting the transitioning us to a better future. Because without these spaces, people, we continue pursuing individual dreams, yeah, individual, mm-hmm. like we take an individualistic route. Yeah. And but when you put these spaces, then you start collective dreaming and then dream weaving these with the place, with the land.
And how in that process do you activate a collective response to the individual dream? So how does it work?
That's where I was going to mm-hmm. Going. It goes back to rediscovering who we are,
mm-hmm.
who we are as first of all as humans, as a species, yeah. But then more specifically as a people, as a community, you know. So for example, when we mentioned the concept of returning to Ubuntu, okay,
mm-hmm.
returning to Ubuntu, which is our philosophy or heritage, bioculture heritage that has been passed down across generations, orally, but also practically. It's a philosophy that centers the interdependence and multidimensional richness of life, the nested interdependence. So the whole is the center, okay? And
so in a nutshell, it's something like I am because we are, or you are,
yes.
Right? So,
yeah. There's been... It's hard to pin down to really define it. There's multiple definitions that have been fronted, but the one that I like the most is that we are because everyone participates
mm-hmm.
in this whole. Okay, mm-hmm. So you have agency contributing. The individual is contributing towards the health of this whole place. Mm-hmm. Okay? And when you contrast that with democracy, Western democracy, for example, at least the diluted one that is that we now have, you see that it is democracy centers people, you know, governance of the people, by the people, for the people. You know, mm-hmm. there's no, the whole is not there. Okay. So, Ubuntu is this spiritual twin between the individual and the whole.
I agree with you, but maybe you can still elaborate a little bit about what you mean the whole is not there in democracy. I think that's important because not everybody sees that immediately. So maybe you can help us to see that.
Yeah, by the whole, I mean the everything that is not human is in most cases relegated, you know? It's focused on human, and again, it goes back to was it Descartes who says that I think, therefore I am, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That removes, in a way, the concept of wholeness from the whole, from the way we do things, from the way we think, from the way, from who we are, and the way we do things, okay?
So essentially, it's rooted in another first principle, really, because it says that everything is connected with everything.
Yes.
Even there is maybe this illusion that we can exist on our own, but if you really understand how you are being kept alive, even in a luxurious, fully abstracted Western. Yeah. Northern lifestyle, then you will discover that you're nothing without everything, right?
Exactly.
And okay, so that's another important first principle, I would say.
It is, yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay, but let's move on. So what happens then? So now you're getting the people into coherence around the shared understanding of a dream.
Shared love for their place. And yes, and that's important because then you have a foundation for engaging external support, okay? And so what we have created so far here is created this excitement. We, for example, ask people what's preventing this landowners, for example, what is preventing this place from reaching its potential? And it was the landowners themselves telling us it's the way we use land, it's the way we govern land, it's the way we think or even value land. And when we invite them to, again, visualize a different future, a different relation with land and their place, they were able to shift. So we asked, would you be willing to then contribute land, your land, or essentially collectively govern land or recom on it in a way that so that we are able to attract this investment to restore the wetland and rebuild a better local economy, regenerative economy that works for both humans and nature and the wetland ecosystem. So
and what is your experience with that? Because usually people that I see that have land, they tend to hold on to land and not give it away. What's your experience there?
Yes, thank you. That's important. Actually, one of the comments we had was exactly that many people are in Uganda. He said, "Sitakange, I don't release my property." So, yeah, that's a deeply held sentiment. But then there's a way this visioning that shifts that, yeah, again, to create this coherence. There's a way the visioning, when someone is able to see a future, yeah, that is better than what he has, you know, he's able to contribute to this future, you know, and as long as there are guarantees, of course, that the process will be transparent and that he won't be losing his rights. So the collective governance layer we're talking about, it doesn't mean you lose rights to your land, but that the land gains higher value and potential, you know, for so even the rich people, even the class that you would expect that they want, that they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
They like they have good houses and stuff like that, but when you talk of a better neighborhood, yeah, that's something they want, mm-hmm. you know. And they are willing to contribute to that. So basically visualizing, that's the power of creating a visual image in the mind that is different. So, yeah.
Okay. So the shared dream allows people to buy into or engage in action that they otherwise wouldn't, because they otherwise would be protective. But now they see that everybody gets to gain, including themselves, if they let go of some of their held on beliefs and rights in the here now.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily letting go, but integrating what people have,
their participating,
contributing,
So now it is imaginable to me that this works in the context of the culture in Uganda, because culturally you have somewhere embedded that notion of Ubuntu,
interdependence,
of interdependence. And do you think that this is something that can function in other cultural contexts? I mean, you have experience in Europe and in the Arabic space. Do you think it would be possible to do the same thing in those spaces, or is that exclusive to Africa?
Nice question. I don't think it's exclusive to Africa. I don't think it's exclusive to Africa. It's just that we haven't been, we are closer to our cultural roots, which is withering, by the way. Ubuntu is also withering because of this, the strong wave of Western development. It's really withering at a fast rate, but we are still, they still, it's still easier. It's easier in our context, yes. But I think it can also, depending, I think, again, it's around rediscovering who you are, who a community is. And I think that's the first principle, the first step. It might be harder, definitely, in the Western context. Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone in the course, and he was telling me it's hard to imagine what we are doing here. It's hard for him to imagine in the US. So, it's hard, I know, but not necessarily impossible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's something to learn from Africa. And I know that that's a generalization. Africa is a continent, another state. But it's somewhat, although it's obviously culturally diverse, it's a similar generalization as Europe, which is also culturally diverse, but also similar in some aspects, right? So, so if you were to think about what is the first step for somebody who wants to do something similar as you're doing in their place, in their community, what is a first step? What are the steps to move into actually engaging with the community so that it can get into coherence? What would you recommend?
Yes, start from place I is what I would recommend. Starting from place, understanding the essence and potential of a place. And it is important to understand that the difference, the way we place, the Western understanding, like there's this concept of called bioregion, bioregion, bioregions, yeah. So for example, in Uganda, before the colonialists came, we had this concept of Emitala. We used to organize, to self-organize around Emitala, yeah. Mm-hmm. A Western mind would translate that as an estate, yeah.
Okay.
Something to be extracted, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But an indigenous mind would translate Emitala as bioregions, because it means respecting natural boundaries of the lake, mm-hmm. of the wetland, of the river, okay, mm-hmm. as sources of abundancy, you know. And mm-hmm. and so the starting point is understanding a place. So it goes back to where we started, seeing the whole, you know. And so inviting people, the community, to see this elephant as a whole, you know. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. that story of the blind man and the elephant.
Yeah, and everybody sees a different thing, a snake and I don't know,
yes.
what the other images are, yeah. But
yes, yes.
But doesn't that take time? How, in my experience, understanding place from many perspectives, it requires you to sit still and observe place for a long time so you can really start seeing patterns and cycles. What would you say, or how much time should people put into getting to know place?
That's the other first principle, I guess, that we are usually drawn to short term outcomes, mm-hmm. and which usually, again, because you came with a problem solution mindset, reduces the potential of what you could achieve. Mm-hmm. There is a project here that won a grant, yeah, to build this kind of a city. Let's call it a smart city as they had planned it. But then they realized they would have to call to talk to landowners, and that would take a long process. They thought, and so they shifted to another place, and because they couldn't, they thought it was hard for them to work with the complexity of bring the community together around a place. And I totally agree. There is trust is the basis of all this. And unfortunately, the system, the market system, or the generally the development system that we are, doesn't value this idea of rebuilding trust to as the source. So yes, it takes time, but the benefits can be, you know, higher order, you know, in terms of restoration of culture, in terms of restoration of ecosystems, restoration of this relationship between humans and nature. Yeah, I mean, these relations were not broken in one day. Or mm-hmm. It took years to break them. So it's going to take time
to heal them.
Yeah. So, but for context, we started this work in a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we've created this excitement in the community. And people are willing to collaborate. 92% are willing to collaborate. 92% of landowners are willing to contribute land to this shared vision because they see the potential of what this place could be. Yes, because of shared love for what could be.
That's powerful. Yeah. So how many people are we thinking about in total? How many people live there?
So this is an urban place, highly dense. It's dense, densely populated, fragmented also. Land is really fragmented. And in terms of numbers, we don't yet have the exact numbers. That will come along the way as we start engaging the city council and other partners. Mm-hmm. But it's around 200, between 200 and 700, if I'm not mistaken, landowners or households that...
So all of that work, I think, points to the value of looking at first principles and really building up from first principles and remembering lost first principles. And I believe that there is a vast knowledge base of these kinds of first principles that is existent but not accessible, meaning it's somewhere stored in us just by way of being a human being, but we don't actively have the ability to access it.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what kind of first principle do you see that is of such kind that we all share it just because we're humans, and that if we lifted it up into our conscious mind, if we actually started to remember it, it would help us live into and towards a shared dream. So what kind of lost knowledge would you like us to remember?
Yeah. It's the human role. It's around the human role. Yeah.
Okay.
That for the last 500 years of colonial domination, we have the human role has been diluted, has been distorted towards extraction. And our role on Earth is not extracting. It's, caring for life. It's contributing to life. To thrive, you know, and in a way, people think colonialism colonized the global South, but it colonized the global role, the global human role. Yeah, that even the colonizers are colonized to this extractive role human role that centers extraction over contributing, over caring for life. And when you look at who we are, really, it's even embedded in our brains. Yeah. There is this a neuro writer, an author, or what's it called? They are called neurosurgeons or something like that. And she had a stroke. She's called Jill Bolton. She had a stroke, and she in mm-hmm. her brain, and she had a chance to observe her brain.
There's a TED talk around that, right? It's called Stroke of Insight.
Stroke of Insight, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so you can see that the left brain is more concerned about it's this problem-solving mind, thinking a reductionist way. But the right brain is about relationships, okay? Mm-hmm. It's about empathy. It's about creativity and curiosity, yeah? And that's something we've forgotten. We hardly tap into that right brain. We are mostly in the left brain, even in spiritual. In spiritual traditions, if you go to spiritual traditions, we have these called science talk of the selfish gene, but then there's also a selfless gene. We are also selfless. Okay, so there is this. We've forgotten to. It's already there. But it's like blocked by this colonial thinking that has dominated who we are now, and to do that, I think we need to rediscover how we think and how who we are, also so that we can shape what we do. Carol Sanford, who I don't know if you know her, has this framework with three levels. On the top level, you have beliefs, philosophy, and principles, okay? Mm-hmm. And on the middle level, so you draw a line there, and you have concepts, strategies, and design. And you draw another line there, and you have implement, audit, and evaluate. And the car is usually when we are designing policies, when we are designing products, corporate products or services, policies, or you know anything that we are bringing to the market or whatever to communities, we start in the middle. We start on the concept, strategies, on concept, strategies, and design. We hardly think about the beliefs and philosophies and principles that underlie. So that means we are building on these colonial beliefs, you know? Mm. Yes, so it's important to rediscover who we are, as a species, because like I said, we have capacity for being relational, being interdependent,
and I just want to use the lens of Ian McGilchrist to actually bring this full circle and also offer an opportunity here to get one more first principle, which is, if you look at Ian McGilchrist's work, he also emphasizes the continuous dance between the left and the right hemisphere.
Yes.
And in their collaboration, in their continuous fluctuation between them, there's a continuous dance happening between the structuring, planning left side and the fully integrating non-judgmental right side.
Yes.
And only in the collaboration between those two, or in other, how John Verwicke might phrase it, the opponent processing that happens between those two different but similar entities, emerges our sense-making apparatus, our consciousness, all of these things, right? And
yes,
and that's what Ian McGilchrist also sees and also assigns to us as a civilization. And in this sense, I want to limit the us to the North Atlantic, to Europe and the US mostly. We are actually, by downregulating the right part of the hemisphere, we're moving into a modality of schizophrenia, because schizophrenia is exactly that, the downregulation of the right hemisphere. And then the left hemisphere takes over and tries to understand everything in like little descriptive blocks that can be put together, which is
holistic
to the beginning, the complicatedness of things that never can rise up to the complexity of things, where problem solution sets are appropriate measure, which then turns out they're not, because they create these wicked problems, right?
Yes.
So the opportunity in this is that the deep understanding that opponent processing, the integration of polar opposites, is at the very, very foundation of life. If you look at what a cell is doing, a cell is ingesting chaos from its environment and turning it into order by creating a copy of itself.
Yes.
If it stops doing that, if it stops that dance between between order and chaos, it stops living. And so there's opportunity in engaging in the dance between polar opposites, in the colonial mindset and in the Ubuntu mindset, and see what emerges between them. So yes. I think you're in a perfect position through your journey to do that. And I'm grateful for the work that you're doing. It's very, very aligned with the work that we are doing in this and in other contexts. And I'm also grateful for your time today so that you could share this with us. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much. What you just described there reminded me of what I said earlier. It's Ubuntu is a twin between the individual and the whole.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's just what you just described there, this continuous relationship, this continuous interplay between the left brain and the right brain. But what you also, to summarize this engagement, as you are talking there, I was reminded of what I read in a book called Everything Flows. In nature, everything flows. That's what, and they were giving this example that. So the argument is that we usually see life in objects, but actually, life is a process. You are a process. A dog is a process, as opposed to this kind of object. Mm-hmm. So they gave a thought experiment that I thought was, it remained with me. And they say that it goes like, imagine a dog, an alien dog that has the capacity to to see the composition of not an alien dog, an alien. Yeah? And it comes from wherever it comes, and it comes on Earth and it scans a dog and a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then it stores that information and it goes back.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes back after 1 year. And then it does that same scanning. It will see that the dog has changed, but mm-hmm. the computer hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that means that the dog or life is
in continuous flow. Mm-hmm.
In continuous flow. It's relating with the external environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No, the eternal environment is consistently relating with the external environment, and if we see life, if we see the process, the things that we do in that way, I think that can also shift a lot in our awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, yes. Thank you so much.
That's a beautiful picture to describe that thing. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you for your time. It was a beautiful insight into the work you're doing. And I'm really, really grateful for that same work. It's a really important.
Thank you so much. It was great learning together.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
Bye.